narrative sources and military and government correspondents make it clear that white Southern women knew the most obnoxious features of slavery all too well. Slave-owning women not only witnessed the most brutal features of slavery, they took part in them, they profited from them, and defended them.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thanks for joining us on this fine April evening to discuss our ever-evolving history, in particular as it alludes to the legacy of slavery. I'm Mary Stack, Director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight it is the turn of women to come under our scrutiny. In the book, They Were Her Property, we are going to examine the role that white women played as slave owners in the American South. According to tonight's guest speaker, Professor Stephanie Jones Rogers, historian and author from UC Berkeley, it is now estimated that 40% of slave owners may have been white women. Most Americans know that George Washington owned enslaved people at his Mount Vernon home. Fewer know that his wife, Martha, dramatically increased the number of their slaves. When they wed in 1759, George owned 18 people, while Martha, one of the richest women in Virginia, owned 84. Contrary to the Gone with the Wind romanticism we have been sold in Hollywood, many of these women were fiercely active participants in the slave market and constituted a major economic force. They also fought to maintain the wealth and free labor that slavery provided them throughout the Civil War. Yet, as Jones Rogers argues in her book, it was not only white women's ideological and sentimental connections to slavery that made them defend it. Scarlett O'Hara would have been protecting her financial assets, too. Tonight's moderator will be Tim Weiskill, African historian and social anthropologist, who is currently digitizing maps of the slave trade. But to tell us more about the hidden history of white women slave owners in the American South, we're very pleased to welcome someone who spent 10 years researching the topic, Professor Stephanie E. Jones Rogers.
Thank you so much for coming tonight. I know you have much on your agenda, and I appreciate your presence here. So let's start with James Redpath. And in 1859, after touring the antebellum South, the journalist and New York Tribune editor attempted to explain for his readers why white Southern women opposed emancipation. He believed that their sentiments were tied to a lifetime of indoctrination, reared as they were under the shadow of the peculiar institution. Slavery was incessantly praised and defended, he argued, virtually everywhere they went, by everyone they knew, and in most of the publications they read. Their consciences, thus early perverted, were never afterwards appealed to, with the result that they saw no reason to change their views. Redpath assumed that white Southern women did not know Negro slavery as it is because their society shielded them from the institution's horrific realities. Insulated by Southern patriarchs, white women seldom saw slavery's most obnoxious features. They never attend slave auctions, never witness examinations, and seldom, if ever, see the Negroes lashed, he said. More profoundly, they didn't know that the interstate slave trade in slaves was a, quote, gigantic commerce, end quote. Southern men revealed only the South side view of slavery, Redpath argued. And if the women of the South knew slavery as it is, he was convinced they would join in the protests against it. Redpath's assumptions represented a commonly held patriarchal view. Yet narrative sources, legal and financial documents, and military and government correspondence make it clear that white Southern women knew the most obnoxious features of slavery all too well. Slave-owning women not only witnessed the most brutal features of slavery, they took part in them, they profited from them, and defended them. So after hearing what Redpath had to say And after I read Redpath's Roving Editor, which was the book where these excerpts were taken, you know, I immediately began to think about this particular kind of image of a slave auction. White men gathered around enslaved people, seeking to interrogate them, to find out about their skills, what they brought to the table, so to speak, as laborers. But what's obviously missing to me are the women. There are no women at this auction. And so from James Redpath's kind of imagining his conceptualization of slavery and women's relationship to it, or really the lack thereof, you get this impression that women weren't invested in the economy of American slavery, that they may have, in fact, been ideologically invested. They may have indirectly benefited from the labor of enslaved people that were owned by the men in their lives. But rarely, if ever, do we think about, and Redpath clearly didn't think either, about the ways in which white women were directly invested in the economy of American slavery, meaning that they bought and sold enslaved people, they hired them, and they received their wages and pocketed those wages in order to benefit their families and their own well-being. Another kind of image that I think comes to mind reading Redpath's conceptualization or description of white women's relationships to slavery is this indirect way that they were rather disconnected from the horrors of slavery, the ways in which these traumas that were enacted in the slave market. What you see here is an enslaved child being separated from the mother, their mother, and you see people on looking, and in the back, a white woman and a white child. There, but not connected to the scene. There, but passively observing the scene. And for Redpath and many, many historians before this, this would ring true. This would be the kind of more accurate idea or conceptualization of white women's connections to the horrors of slavery. They were, in fact, disconnected. But when you listen to, and what I did was I said, okay, well, what happens if we listen to those individuals who would be most most capable of telling us what life was like in slavery as an individual owned by a woman? What if we listened to what they had to say? What if we listened to what formerly enslaved people had to say? And when I began to listen to what formerly enslaved people had to say, they made it clear that white Southern women's economic relationships to slavery didn't begin in adulthood. It began in childhood, and in some cases during infancy. And so what you see in this image, for those of you who can see the image, this is also being recorded, so there are certain people that may not be able to see the image, is an enslaved woman with two young white children, one identifiably female white child. And so formerly enslaved people, when you listen to what they have to say about the women's kind of deep investments in the economy of slavery, is that those investments, those relationships began at these very early ages, even in infancy. They talk about enslaved people who were given to young white girls, sometimes even infants, when they were in childhood. So, for example, Fillmore Hancock told his interviewer in the 1930s, these federal employees who were put to work by the federal government during the Great Depression, who interviewed formerly enslaved people to find out what they had to say about their experiences in slavery. One of them asked Fillmore Hancock about his experience in slavery, and so he talked about his grandmother, and he told his interviewer that his grandmother was given to Mrs. as her own on the day his grandmother was born. Remarkably, Hancock recalled that old Mrs. was only a year old when that happened. So Fillmore Hancock is recalling that his grandmother, who was also a child, was given to a young white girl when she was only one. So when we listen to formerly enslaved people, they say these things. They talked about this kind of lifelong process of socialization by which white girls came to understand themselves as markedly different than enslaved people, and the rituals that drove this point home for the enslaved and the free alike. White slave-owning girls also made it clear
that they had the power to claim other human beings as their property when they selected specific enslaved people to serve them. When Betty Coffer, for example, was born, her master's daughter Ella was only a little girl, but she nevertheless claimed Coffer as her own. Shortly after Betty was born, they played together and they grew up together, according to Betty. And eventually, Betty Coffer became Ella's personal servant, waiting on her, standing behind her chair during dinner, and sleeping beside her on the bedroom floor. But more profoundly, formerly enslaved people tell us that this process of socialization was effective. White girls often made claims of ownership in their conversations with enslaved people. A formerly enslaved woman named Melinda recalled that her young mistress would frequently tell her, "When I get big and get married to a prince, you're going to come with me and tend to all my chillens." And when her mistress married Honor Dufour, she took Melinda with her as part of their new household. As Southern girls, young white women thought about how enslaved people would fit into their lives, not just as playmates or companions, but as property. And when they were old enough, they turned their imaginings into reality. Formerly enslaved people also remarked upon how this process of socialization also involved lessons about slave management and discipline, also referred to in many histories of slavery as mastery. Nancy Thomas recalled that she was the special little girl for her mistress's mistress Harriet's daughter, and that even during them days, she would sew and knit. Nancy, she said, would sit on a three-legged stool, so a very small three-legged stool, and she would sit between her young mistress's legs while she would sew and knit. And if I'd done something wrong, she said, she'd pinch my ear a little and say, "Oh, you dropped a stitch, Nanny." As Nancy Thomas's testimony shows, Polonia Smith, who was her young mistress, was a mistress in the making, a slave owner in the making, responsible for overseeing the production of the enslaved girl she would come to own and discipline her when it did not meet her requirements. And so, yet again, when we talk about formerly enslaved people, when we listen to what formerly enslaved people have to say, we come across accounts like Lit Young's. So Lit Young was owned by a woman named Martha Gibbs. And Martha Gibbs was this really spunky, twice-widowed white woman who was Irish and would outcuss any man, according to Lit. And not only that, but she hired an overseer. So these are typically white men who would, you know, manage the enslaved people who worked in the fields. So she hired an overseer to oversee her slaves. But then Martha wasn't quite sure that he was up to snuff. So Martha would oversee her overseer. Not only that, she built the housing for the enslaved people that she owned. She built a church for their worship. She hired a preacher so that a mulatto preacher in particular, a yellow preacher as Lit called him, so that their souls would be looked after. And when the Civil War came, she knew the writing was on the wall. She knew that her investments in slavery would be dissolved with emancipation. So rather than risk that fate, she picked up her most valuable slaves and she moved them to Marshall, Texas, hundreds of miles away. She not only moved them to Marshall, Texas, but she hired a group of white Irishmen, he referred to them as Irishmen, to guard them overnight so that none of them would run away. And she kept them enslaved a year after the Emancipation Proclamation was enacted. So they were enslaved for an entire year after slavery was over. And she only set them free because the federal government came and said, "This is not okay, you have to let them go. So she finally let them go, but only after they had made her first crop in Texas. So Lit Young, this is Lit Young's account of what had happened to him, what he had experienced, and also kind of this rich account of this woman's deep and profound investments, economic investments in the institution of slavery. And so it was people like Lit that led me to write this book. As I mentioned, they talk about the ways in which white women weren't simply these kind of wilting lilies that, you know, shied away from the violence and the horrors of slavery. These were women who had grown up in slavery, They had grown up in a culture of violence in which they understood that violence was fundamental to submission, fundamental to keeping African Americans in captivity. And so they were not afraid to implement acts of violence, to enact and perpetrate acts of violence against formerly enslaved people. And this was not uncommon from what formerly enslaved people had to say. This was quite common when enslaved people would commit any infraction, even if it was simply burning the biscuits. They talked about white women who enacted a violence against them. So this is a wonderful woman, Marion Kinchian Edwards, and what she talked about when she told her interviewer about her experience in slavery is that she was a wet nurse, and she served as her mistress's wet nurse, and that was the only labor that she had performed during slavery. And so what that said to me was that there's something more to this story here that may in fact be economic in its basis. So what I did was I said, well, how frequent do formerly enslaved people talk about enslaved women serving as wet nurses? And so I combed through the interviews that they did, and found that they talked about it far more frequently than many historians of Southern women and Southern motherhood accounted for. And the reason why I was able to conclude that is in large part because I looked at how formerly enslaved people talked about the practice. So rather than simply looking for words like breastfeed and nursing, I looked specifically for how formerly enslaved people talked about the practice. And so I learned kind of the lexicon through which they talked about wet nursing. And by doing that, I found far more instances in which they talked about the labor that these women performed in this capacity. They talked about the severances and separations that were the consequence of women being taken from their children as a consequence of being forced to, compelled to perform this kind of labor. And not only that, but I said, well, where else could I find evidence to corroborate these women's accounts? And so that's when I went to Southern newspapers and found that throughout Southern newspapers, there were thousands of wanted ads seeking out enslaved people, enslaved women in particular, enslaved mothers in particular, to serve as wet nurses for white children. So what you'll notice is that these advertisements aren't simply about hiring enslaved people, but specifically about purchasing enslaved women to serve in this capacity. And for those of you who know about the female body and about breastfeeding, it's supposed to be a temporary kind of labor. We know mothers, I'm a mother, I learned myself that it's labor, and it's not easy labor either. It takes physiological tolls on the body. And so it did the same in this context. So what these ads show is that when white women called upon enslaved women to serve in this capacity, they created such a demand that it created a niche sector of the slave market, which catered to white mothers seeking enslaved mothers to serve in this capacity. So thousands of these ads appear. Most of the ads reference slave hiring or in hiring of enslaved mothers to serve in this capacity. These ads reference the sale of these women for the purpose of nursing white infants. What's also really important, one of the things that I found that was really important about this market was that the individuals who sought out these individuals and who often proposed to sell them were often slave traders. So slave traders not only specialized in the variety of forms of labor that enslaved people performed, but this was also a very important form of labor that they sought to market as well. So Capers and Hayward, they were a slave trading firm in South Carolina who made their living buying and selling enslaved people, and they recognized enslaved mothers' kind of maternal labor as one that had a value outside of the household. So by listening to what women like Marion Edwards had to say, I was able to further corroborate, and then also discover this really extraordinary dimension of the slave market that catered to white mothers. So it was created by white mothers, and then it was specifically providing
enslaved women, enslaved mothers, for these women and their children. So what do formerly enslaved people have to tell us? They have to tell us so very much about their experiences in slavery, but also about white women's, the kind of dimensions of white women's slave ownership that have rarely ever kind of come to the fore. Up to the very end, white women who owned enslaved people were deeply invested in the preservation of slavery. They were willing to fight for its preservation and its perpetuation. And they were there all along. This book shows that if we listen to what formerly enslaved people had to say about these women, about their economic investments in the institution, we will find a very complex and richer conceptualization of slavery where women are there all along. We just need to pay a little closer attention. So on that note, I will end, and hopefully you have some questions for me. And thank you so much for listening to me today and being here.
You are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our discussion with Professor Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers from UC Berkeley, talking about her book, They Were Her Property, which examines the role of white women slave owners in the South.
So I'm impressed on so many levels and wish to ask some questions to relate it to the one or two things that others might know about, either issues of slavery itself, of which the transatlantic slave trade is the dominant feature. But there were forms of slavery here, especially in New England, that emerged prior to the transatlantic slave trade. We're just beginning to figure out the sort of Indian slave trade in that respect, and how it was eclipsed later by the presence of African populations. And then after the slave-owning period, after the emancipation proclamation, just 2 nights ago in this very same venue, we had Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. talking about the Reconstruction period and then the destruction of the Reconstruction period, largely with the help of, and in many cases the instigation of, white Southern women. And its implications for several things, including education, but the United Daughters of the Confederacy basically emerge as a way of retelling Reconstruction history. And they write it in stone, as he says, that they put up monuments one after another. So I'm curious, in both directions, how would you place this whole experience of women, white ownership of slaves, in the larger context of pre-African American slavery, like the Indian slavery in the Northeast, and then afterwards too? Is there any follow-on from your own work, for example, to the post-Reconstruction role of white women in reinventing the narrative of the slave-owning past?
Absolutely. So they sanitize their economic investments in the institution after slavery is over in these kind of very nostalgic, lost cause autobiographies, I guess you could say. And what's really interesting is that in the beginning, in the dedications, they make it very clear that they have an audience in mind when they write them. They talk about they dedicate them to their children, their children's children, and their children's children's children. So they have their descendants specifically in mind in many cases. And in their prefaces, they talk about the ways in which they're writing this so that their children's children will know what it was like for them as young women. And in those accounts, they sanitize their economic investments in slavery disappear. They talk about how slavery was a positive and good institution, and how their roles were simply as kind of maternal figures who cared for these dependents in the ways that they cared for their children. So there's a way in which white slave owning women after slavery is over kind of construct these these narratives that I think coincide with the monuments that emerge. They're telling a very sanitized version of slavery that erases the trauma, erases the horrors that you can see, those separations, the trauma of those separations that formerly enslaved people talked about, but of course formerly enslaved people are often telling a very different story at the same time. They're constructing a counter narrative. The other thing that's really important is that the women that are in this book often owned one or two slaves, at the most 10 slaves. So these are the overwhelming majority of slave owners in the South who owned 10 or less, 10 slaves, 10 enslaved people or less. But there were a group of very elite slave owning women who owned sometimes in the double digits, enslaved people in the double digits, like Martha Washington, but also had over $20,000 in property after, you know, after the war. And those women, their property was often confiscated by the government. And so in order to get that property back, they would have to apply for amnesty in order to get that property back. And so they would petition, they would write these letters to Andrew Johnson. This is after Lincoln was assassinated, and tell these stories about how the losses of their slaves impacted them. So they don't have to do this. They simply have to fill out a form and send it in. But they take time to write these letters about how the government robbed them of this immense wealth, and that they're really sour about it. So there's this way in which they're constructing narratives that in one moment, when it's away from the public eye, when it's away from the eye of their descendants, tell a very vivid picture of their economic investments. But after slavery is over and after the writing is clearly dry on the wall, they're removing those economic elements of the narrative and telling a very sanitized account, offering a very sanitized account that positions them as positive influences.
I mean, I think it's an understatement to say it's sanitized. It's clearly propagandized in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's open it to some questions.
I'm interested in the narratives of the women slave owners. How did these women justify the pain and the tears and the separation that they must have seen?
They talked about the fact that enslaved people, that African descended people, didn't feel the same way that white folks felt. That they were not the same kind of sentient beings, that they were not the same kind of emotional creatures, emotional beings, as white folks were. And they weren't making this up. This was language that we can see even in the slave trade. When Britain was trying to figure out whether they wanted to abolish the slave trade, they had these interviews. So there were individuals who came to testify before them. And they would often ask them, well, did they seem bothered when they were separated from their families and sold off to the New World? And these individuals who were employed in the slave trade would say, oh no, they clearly didn't feel anything. You know, actually they were quite happy. They actually argued that African captives were happy to leave and go to the New World, and that they didn't mind being separated from their families and their loved ones and even their homelands. So this is very old language, and women often justified these separations by saying that these enslaved mothers didn't feel the same way about their children as we feel about our children. So they would often excuse it away by saying that African Americans weren't as emotionally connected to their children and their loved ones more broadly. So that's how they justified it.
So thank you, Professor Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers, for your extremely illuminating talk here. And it's given us a whole new perspective, I think, on this topic. You've been listening to They Were Her Property, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Stephanie E. Jones-Rogers, talking about her book, which investigates the role of white women slave owners in the American South. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, Eastern Bank, and Harvard Bookstore. Thank you for joining us, and please do so again.